Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Tomko?
Here.
Vice Chair Bruschetta Cabrera? Representative Botana?
Here.
Brannon?
Here.
Buchanan?
Here.
Chambliss?
Here.
Clemens?
Here.
Fabricio?
Here.
McClure? Morales?
Present.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Representative Roth?
Here.
Stevenson?
Here.
Tant?
Here.
We have a quorum, ma'am.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that all cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or are on silent. If members of the public wishing to address the subcommittee will please fill out an appearance form and give it to the committee administrative assistant, we will know your interest in addressing the subcommittee. Members, we have several items on the agenda today. We will begin with the policy bills, followed by the consideration of the consent agenda, and then have two presentations by the Department of Environmental Protection. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we will move right along to House Bill 761 by Representative Trunow, Inventories of Critical Wetlands. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Members, House Bill 761, Inventories of Critical Wetlands, requires each water management district governing board to cooperate with local governments to develop a list of critical wetlands for acquisition using funds from the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. This bill seeks to encourage a higher level of cooperation between local governments and water management districts. What factors should be considered when prioritizing wetlands for acquisition and conservation? It also has criteria which they will use to establish these wetlands. That is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Trunow. Seeing no amendments, are there any questions of the sponsor of the bill? Seeing no questions, looks like we have someone in the audience who wishes to testify. Lindsay Cross with Florida Conservative Voters, a proponent of the bill. And she is recognized.
Good morning, Chair and Committee. I'm Lindsay Cross, the Water and Land Policy Director with Florida Conservation Voters. Personally, I'm also a lover of all things wetlands, whether it's dark water cypress swamps, ephemeral frog ponds, or our slow-moving systems like the Florida Everglades. Wetlands certainly are one of the most critical habitat types that we have in Florida because of the myriad benefits they provide to people and wildlife. Our wetlands minimize flooding to nearby communities, naturally clean polluted water, and recharge our aquifer, the main source of drinking water for 90% of Floridians. They're also superstars when it comes to storing carbon from our atmosphere. Both our freshwater wetlands and our saltwater wetlands like mangroves and seagrasses. Unfortunately, Florida also has the distinction of having lost more acres of wetlands than any other state in the nation. And with nearly 1,000 people moving to our state every day, we are losing precious acres of wetlands each day to strip malls, big box stores, and subdivisions. I appreciate the conversations that I've had with both the House and the Senate sponsors' staff, and for their commitment to passing a bill that recognizes the value of our wetlands. It is critical to have an accurate and evolving understanding of where our existing wetlands are, the benefits they provide, and where there is immediate danger from development. We have discussed how this work and this assessment can be done proactively to protect these valuable ecosystems and build upon the existing data and resources that we have from our water management districts and other entities. For example, the Florida Natural Areas Inventory provides ecological data and mapping of habitats that are being considered for acquisition or conservation easements as part of our state-funded conservation programs. Since this bill specifically references the Land Acquisition Trust Fund as a source of funding, this wetland inventory should be used to complement the rigorous and science-based process used to evaluate and prioritize projects for funding through the Florida Forever Priority List or Rural and Family Lands. It is imperative that this work is done to complement and support the programs that we already have rather than to supersede or replace them. Finally, the act of classifying anything into categories can suggest that there are winners or losers. What this exercise should not do is provide a rationale to more easily fill or destroy those wetlands deemed as non-critical. Clearly, there are ecological gems in our state that are worth protecting with our public dollars because of their extraordinary benefit. Places like the Everglades or Payne's Prairie come to mind. But there are also less extraordinary wetlands that still provide water and carbon storage and wildlife habitat. Our hope that is this, that this exercise will further support the need for comprehensive and consistent funding and protection of our wetlands. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Jane West, who waves in support with 1,000 Friends of Florida. All right, members, do we have any debate on the bill? Seeing no debate, Representative Trunow, you are recognized to close.
Wave close, Chair.
Representative Trunow, having closed on the bill, Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Tomko?
Yes.
Vice Chair Brashada Cabrera?
Yes.
Representative Botana?
Yes.
Brennan?
Yes.
Buchanan?
Yes.
Chambliss?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Fabricio?
Yes.
McClure? Morales?
Yes.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Representative Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Favorable, ma'am.
Members, by your vote, show House Bill 761 will be reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right, next, members, we have House Bill 513, Comprehensive Review Study of the Central Florida Project by Representative Bartleman and our Vice Chair, Representative Buzada Cabrera. You ladies are recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and to my Vice Chair, I'm very happy you're standing beside me here. And to Ranking Member Umfroy, I'm happy to be here. This is House Bill 513. The Central and Southern Florida Flood Control System is one of the most complex flood control systems in the world. It ensures South Florida stays dry and we have available fresh water from our aquifer for nearly half of Florida's residents. The system is over 70 years old and in dire need of upgrades. The series of gates along the coast open when it rains and let water flow out to sea, but it also keeps salt water out to protect our freshwater aquifer. Sea level rise is challenging many of the gates, meaning they cannot open when it rains at high tide. Water will back up and flood our western communities. This is not just about our coastline communities, it's about our inland communities all over South Florida. The federal government, who built and owns the system, is aware of the challenges and yet is incredibly, incredibly slow to act. House Bill 513 requires the South Florida Water Management District to consolidate portions of their annual sea level rise and flood resilience plan and update the legislature on the status of these upgrades and keep the legislature informed. Upgrading the system is no easy feat and will require sustained efforts at all levels of government. We can set the foundation for a strong and resilient future.
Thank you, Representative Bartleman, for explaining the importance of the Central and Southern Florida Flood Control System in keeping South Florida safe. The system protects 11 million Floridians, and this is about protecting our environment and our economy. We must work together to expedite the review and upgrade to the system, and this bill does just that. The Florida legislature has already prioritized flooding and sea level rise as a critical issue facing the state and has made historic investments to strengthen its resilience efforts. The success of the system is dependent on the continued financial and policy investments in flooding and sea level rise by the Florida legislature.
And that is the bill, Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no amendments, members, do we have any questions of the sponsors of the bill? Seeing no questions, I see we have some members of the audience that wish to testify. We have Frank Bernardino with the town of Cutler Bay. You are recognized.
Good morning, Madam Chair. First, thank you to the sponsors for sponsoring this bill, to the chair for hearing the bill, and Leader Umfroy for agreeing to hearing the bill as well. Cutler Bay is at ground zero for sea level rise. We're a community in South Miami-Dade County. We are at highest risk for sea level impacts. And what this study will allow is produce an executive summary, an actionable document that the legislature will receive in a timely manner for you to consider any funding needs that the agency may have in support of refurbishing these structures and providing the needed flood control for the communities of South Florida. The communities of Broward, Dade, and Palm Beach County have worked with the district in the drafting of this bill, and we believe that the information will be vital to help you make decisions as you set your budget priorities in future years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Anna Upton with the Everglades Foundation waving in support. Natalie Fossell with Palm Beach County waving in support. Beth Alvey with Audubon, Florida, waving in support. And sorry, we have a couple more. Jane West with 1,000 Friends of Florida, waving in support. Lindsay Cross with Florida Conservation Voters, waving in support. All right, members, do we have debate on the bill? Representative Roth, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for bringing this great bill. I reached out to Representative Bartleman. Obviously, I'm very much up on this whole concept. I actually did tidal valves for the city of West Palm Beach appropriation last year, and their city of West Palm Beach is planning to put in at least 20 tidal valves to protect water from coming in when you have king tides and rainfall, and you're trying to release water by gravity into the Atlantic Ocean. And so they're putting in these tidal valves, kind of like a check valve. So there's no doubt that this is a necessary component and needed to be highlighted. It's going to be interesting to see what the annual report says about the flooding and additional problems due to king tides and sea level rise, because you're talking about land that's in many places in South Florida is 5 feet, 10 feet above sea level. So thank you for this bill.
Seeing no further debate, Representative Bartleman, you are recognized to close on the bill.
I think Representative Roth did a great job closing on our bill. Thank you very much. We waive close.
Wonderful. Representative Bartleman having closed on the bill, Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Tomko?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bruschotta Cabrera?
Yes.
Representative Botana?
Yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Buchanan?
Yes.
Clements?
Yes.
Chambliss?
Yes.
Fabricio?
Yes.
McClure? Morales?
Yes.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Representative Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Favorable, ma'am.
Members, by your vote, show House Bill 513 will be reported favorably. Congratulations, ladies. All right, members, next we are about to take up the consent agenda for appropriations project bills. We will take up the consent agenda, vote once on the agenda in its entirety, and the public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up, question, debate, and vote on each of the bills individually. Instead, we will be in questions and debate only once. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a nay vote consent agenda form before the vote. Members, in your packet, there is a list of the appropriation project bills. With that being said, are there any questions? Seeing no questions, it looks like we have some public testimony. Thank you. We have Thomas Hobbs with the Village of Wellington waving in support. Thomas Hobbs Indian Trail Improvement District waving in support. Julie Fess with the Town of Oakland waving in support. Larry Williams with the Town of Oakland waving in support. Thomas Hobbs with the City of Daytona Beach waving in support. Members, is there any debate? Seeing no debate, before I call the vote on the consent agenda, are there any nay forms? Adrian, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda, with the exception of any of the no votes on any of the bills that were just announced.
Chair Tomko?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bruschotta Cabrera?
Yes.
Representative Botana?
Yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Buchanan?
Yes.
Chambliss?
Yes.
Clements?
Yes.
Fabricio?
Yes.
McClure? Morales?
Yes.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Yes. Representative Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Favorable, ma'am.
Members, by your vote, show all of the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Thank you, Adrian. Members, next up, we will have a presentation by the Department of Environmental Protection on state park projects. Next, we will have with us Justin Wolf and the department with the Department of Environmental Protection, Interim Chief of Staff. Mr. Wolf, you are recognized.
Thank you for having me here today to talk about Florida's state park system. I'm Justin Wolf. I'm the acting chief of staff for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. The Florida Park Service was established in 1935 and includes 175 state parks, trails, historic sites that are managed by the Department of Environmental Protection. These parks and trails provide visitors with access to the best natural and cultural sites in the state. Our state's parks are managed in a way that preserves them for the enjoyment by this and future generations. The Florida Park Service is the nation's only four-time winner of the National Gold Medal for Excellence. With 175 state parks and trails spanning nearly 800,000 acres, 2,300 miles of trails, and 100 miles of sandy beaches, the Florida Park Service is one of the country's largest park systems. Our state parks employ more than 1,000 people and generated $4.4 billion in direct economic impact last fiscal year. Florida state parks are consistent and reliable drivers for both visitation and revenue. Annual attendance typically falls between 25 and 30 million visitors and revenue approaching $70 million. Our state parks continue to grow in popularity, and just several months into this fiscal year have already broken revenue records compared to previous years. The vast majority of revenue generated by state parks comes from day use entrance fees and overnight reservation fees. Nearly 25% of state parks are free to visitors, making our parks a tremendous value, not only compared with other recreational spaces in the state, but also compared with the state park systems around the nation. Fees for overnight accommodations, which include campsites and cabins, are also very affordable, and more than two-thirds of overnight visitors are Florida residents. The Florida park system is divided into five districts. Each district has its own wave of seasonality, although some parks are extremely popular year-round. This table shows the attendance and revenue for fiscal year 2021. For the most part, both are spread evenly across the state. Last fiscal year, Honeymoon Island State Park in Pinellas County was the most popular park with almost 1.5 million visitors. Topsail Hill Preserve State Park in Walton County generated the most revenue last fiscal year, bringing in over $3.6 million. The Florida Parks Service is tasked with being the steward of Florida's natural and cultural resources, often associated with natural resources such as springs, waterways, forests, and dunes. State parks also include equally important cultural resources, such as Native American cultural sites and historic forts and battlefields. Managing these resources while hosting 25 to 30 million visitors annually takes quite a balancing act, but it's important to ensure the preservation of these natural and cultural values. Approximately $168 million was appropriated to state parks for fiscal year 2021 through 22, and around $18.4 million has been allocated this fiscal year for resource management. Natural resources form the foundation of our recreational programs and must be actively managed. Caring for these resources ensures that Florida residents and our visitors have opportunities to experience a piece of Florida in its natural state. Prescribed burns, invasive plant removal, restoration of hydraulic flow are some of the tools that state parks use to manage these resources. State park staff regularly conduct these management techniques to improve the habitat and create recreational opportunities for visitors. This slide shows a great example of our natural resource management efforts at Torreya State Park in Liberty County. In 2001, the Florida Park Service acquired a large tract of land that for years had been used as a pine plantation. The trees planted there were not appropriate for the surrounding habitat and were packed too tightly together to allow natural vegetation and wildlife to flourish. The Florida State Park Service has been working to restore this land to its natural state. This ongoing project is expected to be completed in 2024 and will restore 4,600 acres of sandhill habitat through the replanting of longleaf pine and wiregrass. In addition to natural resources, state parks are also responsible for managing cultural resources. Acquired by the state for their historic significance, these resources include historic structures and archaeological sites. Monitoring the condition of these resources and conducting routine maintenance and rehabilitating historic structures ensures that they will be preserved for the future. An example of our cultural resource management can be found here at Alfred B. McClay Garden State Park here in Tallahassee. The wood shake shingle roof on the historic McClay House was last replaced in 2001 and was in dire need of attention to address leaks and warped shingles. To increase the house's resilience to weather conditions while also preserving its historic aesthetic, in November 2020, the park replaced the old shingles on the new on the roof. In addition to managing natural and cultural resources, $36 million in fixed capital outlay funding has been allocated this year to support construction and maintenance projects. These projects include repairing and maintaining roads, building and other infrastructure, construction of new facility, enhancing the safety and accessibility to park resources. We have developed several tools to track deferred maintenance throughout the state park system, including an annual assessment of all structures within the state parks. Projects are evaluated and ranked to identify those that are priorities for the year, and that ranking is used to develop an annual spending plan for these projects. This spending plan focuses on categories like water quality, visitor services, historic structures, and ADA accessibility. The next few slides will show an example of some recent projects. At Hugh Taylor Birch State Park in Fort Lauderdale, portions of the main road were widened for further space pedestrians and bikers from vehicular traffic and enhance visitor safety. The new 4-foot bike pedestrian lane provides safer experience while still preserving the park's natural setting in an otherwise urban environment. Next month, we will finish the replacement of a non-compliant kayak launch with an ADA accessible launch at Little Manatee River State Park. This new kayak launch was specifically designed for the Manatee River's dynamic flow and water levels. At Bill Baggs Cape Florida State Park, we repaired 1,475 linear feet seawall. These repairs will add many years to the life of the seawall by halting erosion, slowing down corrosion, and restoring structural integrity. Last month, we completed the construction of a new ADA accessible canoe and kayak launch at Favor Dykes State Park in St. Johns County. This slide shows a project of adding new concrete stairs and an ADA-compliant chairlift and guardrail that was recently completed at the Ishinatuckney Springs State Park. The Ishinatuckney Springs is an extremely popular place for tubing, canoeing, kayak, and swimming, and these enhancements have expanded access to the head spring for all visitors. And lastly, DEP is excited to reopen the first phase of the Billy Joe Risch Recreational Area this coming Friday. The Risch Recreational Area was established by the Florida Legislature in 1978 as a recreation area for persons with disabilities. This 100-acre recreational area is located on Cape San Blas near Port St. Joe in the Florida Panhandle. The park was previously managed by the Agency for Persons with Disabilities and had been closed since sustaining damage from Hurricane Michael in October 2018. Management was transferred to the Florida Park Service on December 1, 2001, and $6.7 million is included in the governor's fiscal year 2022-23 budget recommendations for the park. Boardwalks and handrails have recently been repaired, which will allow guests to access both the Gulf of Mexico and St. Joe Bay. Additional modular restrooms have been installed on-site, along with new ADA parking and renovations to guest cottages. The Olympic-sized swimming pool and overnight cabins will be open soon. These are just a few examples of the various types of projects completed at our state parks to maximize visitor experience every year. Thank you, and that concludes my presentation, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Members, do we have any questions? Ranking Member Omfroy, you are recognized.
Thank you so very much, Chair. I just did, I'm not the greatest with math, but I just did a calculation based on the people that actually visit our parks compared to how much revenue we bring in from our parks. And if I'm not mistaken, it's like $2.35 per person. Am I correct?
You're recognized.
I would have to do the math myself, but I'll trust you. That sounds right.
When is the last time we've looked at... I had this conversation with the secretary when he's here. I'm sure you were prepared for me to ask you the same exact question. If you weren't, you're getting it now. When are we going to do an assessment of how Florida compares to other states, national park systems, and what they charge? As a resident of the state of Florida, should we have a special price for people with Florida driver's license or residents of the state of Florida? When you go to other state parks and other states, they charge per person in the car, and they charge per car. Are you looking at those assessments, and when can we expect to hear about those assessments? Because we have such beauty here, and we're not charging adequately to ensure that these beautiful parks have the resources they need to maintain the beauty that they have. You know, they could possibly take care of themselves if we charge correctly.
You're recognized.
Thank you. We do look at the fee structures, and there is a balancing, right, of trying to keep these affordable to allow as much access as possible, while also, you know, allowing these parks to have revenue to support themselves. It is something we look at, and from, you know, the comparisons that we've done, we believe we fall within the range of allowing our parks to remain affordable, but being in similar to other parks around the nation. We did recently implement a 7-day daily utility fee for for the RVs, just for the utility costs have gone up so much due to the size of RVs and the electric use and wastewater use. But that is something we continually evaluate, and we will continue to.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you very much, Chair. When was the last time we did an assessment on our parks compared to other parks? Is it possible for me to please get, and my colleagues maybe, to please get the information on us compared to other state parks? Because is it possible for us to see when the last time you assessed this? And us compared to other major state parks, probably the ones that have received awards lately? The other thing is, have we thought about making sure that Florida residents have access to the parks compared to people who are coming in from other states? Yes, we want everybody to enjoy our natural resources, but we can't seem to enjoy the resources we're paying for. We have a reservation system for just if somebody pulls up, you know, you guys leave like 10% open for people who arrive. Is there a possibility of us reserving some spaces for Florida residents to ensure that we're able to use the parks that we pay for? Thank you.
I'm happy to follow up with staff on the comparison and get that information to you. I do know that we've been working with our vendor to figure out a way to prioritize Florida residents for their ability to use the state parks as well.
Representative Tant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to say to you, thank you for the work you're doing to make our parks ADA compliant, and also doing the repairs you're doing. In respect to the Risch Park, which I'm thrilled about, thank you for taking that over, and thank you for handling it so seamlessly. I'm excited that they're opening for folks to start enjoying this Friday. My question is, on the overnight and pool repairs, ballparking it, knowing that you can't predict, you know, supply, labor, building costs and what have you, in permitting. What would your ballpark guesstimate be about opening for that?
I don't know at this time. That's something we're kind of working on, trying to get the repairs done. We're, like I said, this Friday trying to get it open for day use, and we'll open the other phases as quick as we possibly can.
Well, thank you. And
follow up,
Madam Chair. So this is a question totally out of ignorance here. So following up on Rep. Umfroy's questions, when a park generates the fees that they do, do they keep those fees for their own use, or is it put in an overall pool that you all have? I'm just curious how it works.
You're recognized.
It is put into a trust fund, and then we are then appropriated.
It's statewide. It goes into a statewide pool.
I believe it goes into the state park trust fund.
Gotcha. Thank you. Okay.
Members, any further questions? I have a couple, if you don't mind. I was curious what the current backlog for your projects in state parks is.
So we have the current deferred maintenance projects in a total of $137 million.
Thank you. And also was wondering, I noticed that the Northwest region has the lowest attendance yet the most resources. Do you mind elaborating on why that is?
That is due to Northwest, the higher revenue amount is really can be attributed to Topsail Hill Preserve State Park and the overnight accommodations there. There's just a large quantity of cabins, and therefore it generates more revenue.
Wonderful. Seeing no further questions, thank you so much, Mr. Wolf, for being here today. As someone who loves our state parks, our family actually had a cattle lease on Colt Creek State Park, so I'm a little biased to that one in our area. Love the ability to be able to ride horses and go out there still. So thank you for being with us today, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next up, members, we will have the presentation by the Department of Environmental Protection on the Petroleum Restoration Program. Today we will have with us John Truitt, the Department of Environmental Protection Deputy Secretary for Regulatory Programs. Members, we will take questions at the conclusion of this project. Or presentation, I'm sorry. Mr. Truitt, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Members, again, John Truitt, DEP, appreciate the opportunity to be here. So Petroleum Restoration Program. It started in 1986, was created by the legislature to deal with different levels of contamination to protect our soil and drinking water we have in the state. From 86 to 95, it was based on a reimbursement program where people would do cleanup and then submit to the department, and then those reimbursements would be paid. From 96 to 2013, there was a pre-approval process where projects would come in, the department would approve, and then they'd move forward. Since 2014, it's been a competitive procurement process whereby we have agency contractors that go do work. So where are we at today? Because obviously that's the question I think everyone's interested in. So 12,007, as you can see, discharges have been completed, closed out. Just over 4,700 are active, and 2,765 are awaiting. You'll note sites by discharge score there listed on the right, so I was going to talk about the scoring a little bit. So there's a statutory scheme that sets up the scoring of a site, and it's based on the risk to the health, safety, and welfare, including the environment and people that may be drinking groundwater. We also have a rule that breaks down the statutory scheme even more detailed. It's 62771.300. Essentially, the sites go 100, the worst, all the way down to 1. As time has gone on and the program has cleared some sites off the table, we at the department keep reducing the score, meaning the eligible score of a site to be able to get in. As of today, we are back down to 11, so pretty low on the chart, but that explains why you see the graph on the right side there on inactive sites. The ones that are scored above 11 are generally either due to a contractual dispute with the owner or an access agreement issue. We do have legal authority if a site gets bad enough to seek an access order and go through court. We try and use that as a last resort to try and bring the responsible parties and the owners along friendly. But otherwise, you'll see that's why 2,390 sites are inactive, because they are below that score of 11. So this is an idea of the progress in the recent last decade. So these are the number of discharges closed by fiscal year. It does vary. A lot of that can determine based on where the score has been for a while. If you have an immediate score drop, you're going to have a huge flood of sites come into the system that then you wouldn't see as many closures being done by some of the contractors. And you also have on this chart the status of the site assessments. So the assessment is what tells us what is going to need to be done to the site. That helps inform the remedial action plan and any closure that's needed. So we have 53 sites have the initial assessment ongoing. Only 278 need assessment. And we have, of the rest of those site assessments, 7,198 that are approved. That's important to note, because if the initial site assessment is approved, it's a lot easier to pick up the projects and start moving them forward. So a quick look back at funding for the last couple years. So the lightest green. That was what the appropriation that came from the legislature was for that year. And there's a little block on top of it of a slightly darker green. That's a carryover from a prior year. And then on the darkest green, the right column of each one of those, is how much was encumbered during that fiscal year. You'll note there's the obvious one, fiscal year 2021, where only $41 million was encumbered. I've spoken, I think, with many of the members on this committee before as well regarding the pause that occurred during the drop in revenue to the Inland Protection Trust Fund. Through that process, we understand that some folks just look at the straight receipts that are coming in through petroleum sales. However, we're required to use the EDR estimates and a several-year forward look of the health of the trust fund. So to ensure the health of the trust fund, there was a pause on a majority of work going on in the PRP program. But over the last several months, I'm happy to say that we've been able to get back to the score of 11 now, as I mentioned, which is where we were at before that funding pause hit. So next, I'd also like to brag on my folks a little bit. So this is how quickly they get through purchase order issue time and days. We use a lot of metrics in regulatory. This is one of the ones we have stressed to drive down. So you can see a drastic decrease in time just over the last couple years. The asterisk is for any site that fell in that pause because the score raised. We did not keep the clock running on that site, but we turned the clock back on when it came back into funding. So it was essentially like a tolling to make sure that we were getting accurate representation of the sites we were actually being worked on during those time frames. We have a couple other programs that are housed in the PRP program. So there's advanced cleanup. By statute, up to $30 million per year can go toward advanced cleanup, where it's going to be a site that is not in the scoring range, but if the owner wants to increase a cost share or create a savings of 25%, they can go ahead and get their site tackled. That could be for a multitude of reasons. We found it to be fairly effective. So as you can see, we've had 265. We enter into agreements for that since 14. And there's also a reference there to bundles. Sometimes you'll have an entity that'll have multiple properties all together and want to kind of lump it into one big cleanup program. As a sub-sub-part of advanced cleanup, we've got advanced cleanup for redevelopment. So this is tackling those sites that, again, might not be in scoring range. They're not technically eligible. However, you're looking at either blighted areas, inner city. Think of a lot of those old abandoned mom-and-pop gas stations that are down a new economic area that's trying to build up. This program is designed to help get those in and get that done so it doesn't slow down. We would hate for someone to build on top of contamination and then pay to rip the building down, clean up the contamination, and rebuild the building. That's the goal behind this. It's limited to $1 million per site, and you get $5 million a year by statute. And you can see the figures we've had so far. The advanced cleanup and the advanced cleanup redevelopment, there's a period where people can apply to that twice a year. It's right at the early summer and then right toward the end of the year. So coming early this summer, we plan on reopening that again, given the health of the trust fund. So once that reopens, then literally the PRP program will be exactly the same as it was before the pause happened. Foreclosures, we have stressed, like you saw, something to do with the timing on the purchase orders, but also with closures. We have stressed to try and make this as painless as humanly possible and find improvements. So we have increased our level of communication with property owners. I know when I first got to the department, 5 years ago now, that was one of the things I used to get a call for the most, was a non-responsiveness issue, either from a contractor or from someone that was overseeing the contracts. I have not had a call complaining about a PRP site in the last 2.5 years. So I think that has actually been very beneficial. During the competitive procurement process and the ranking of contractors, we've also inserted closure percentage in the program's formula, along with many other factors, to encourage those contractors that do the most closures are going to get a wee bit of an advantage in terms of that scoring compared to other factors. I mentioned access. That's the third bullet here. Like I said, we try to rely on going to court to get an access order as a last resort. When the site owner is hostile to us, that usually creates all kinds of problems. We've done it less than five times in my 5 years in this role. It has wound up working out amicably in the end for all five of those. And then also identifying mega sites, which I've got a slide coming up on what mega sites are. But essentially, we view those as any site cleanup that's going to exceed $10 million, because obviously if you had $10 million from either $115 or $125 million appropriation, looking at just under 10%, that can seriously put a crimp on the operations going on the thousands of other sites at the same time. So we try and catch those ahead of time. We have two mega sites in the state of Florida right now. The first, Port Everglades, it's eligible for funding on one of the original programs that was set up. So the port and the department are working on this. The estimated cost is $25 million. For the demolition and remediation activities, the current work schedule splits that cost roughly half in fiscal year 22-23 and then fiscal year 23-24. Petroleum Products Corporation is another one. It's interesting because that one is a Superfund site, and normally folks see Superfund sites and states only pay 10%. However, a judge ruled back in, I think, 2001 that this was eligible under our EDI. So the state is on the hook for, it's going to be roughly $35 million for this project. Again, that amount, EPA is the lead on that, is roughly going to be $20 million in fiscal year 22-23, and then the remaining $15 million for remediation afterward. That is a very expensive demolition. It's a very heavy industrial area. Every building has to come down and the dirt has to come out. It's quite a few tenants need to be moved and compensated for their property. Now, excuse me, on the timelines I mentioned in the breakdown of cost, we, the department, are not making that up. We're using the contracting entity's lead. So on the petroleum products, that is the EPA's timeline schedule. So that's the best available information I have from the project lead on when those timings are going to land. And on Port Everglades, with the port being the lead, again, that's based on their time schedule. Understanding with any contracting projects, no plan survives the first contact intact. Do we presume it will slip? I would assume, but can I give anyone an estimate of how much? I cannot until they actually start turning dirt. But that is something we are certainly wanting to keep track of, because as I said, depending on the fiscal year those cost impacts hit, it could affect other areas in the program. And then just a quick snapshot in the very near term. So these are the projections we have for the program out, the allocation being also what was coming over from carryover funds from prior years, our operating costs. You'll see discharges moving into the funding. That's kind of a key number that gives you an idea of how many sites are coming that are we anticipate will fall into our scoring range. So you can see a negative 600. That shows the year that there was the pause when the score went up. You had 600 sites roughly that came out. Dropping back down to 11 is going to drive almost another 800 sites into the system. And then moving forward, our overall goal would be to get to the score to 10. By fiscal year 24, that would bring in another 400 or so sites. But again, if you want to, just the flashback is that 22, 23, 23, 24 year are the 2 years we're anticipating an almost combined total of $60 million for the mega projects on Port Everglades and petroleum products. I would also mention we also have another program called the Low-Scored Site Initiative Program. By statute, it's for any site under 30, and it's where the owner has to give a cost savings to the department, and then you can work on your project out of order. It's a maximum of $35,000 for assessment and $35,000 for remediation. A lot of people were taking advantage of that years ago when the score was set up at 40, 45, and that kind of a number. But now that we're all the way down to 11 and you're going to be fully funded, we're seeing the LSSI applications drop off, because I think a lot of people are just assuming, well, they're going to get to me really, really soon. So we've seen a significant decrease in LSSI because we've been so efficient in pushing the score down. So that was all I had, and obviously I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Truitt. Representative Clemens, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a great presentation. I do have a couple series of questions, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
First of all, I support the petroleum cleanup. I remember back in the 80s when there were so many dozens and dozens and dozens of zombie properties whereby they were petroleum contamination. And I know that I'm rehashing, but, you know, people quit paying the mortgage and then the banks failed to foreclose because no one wanted to assume that huge liability. And so, therefore, the states come in with this great program. Are there any programs or files open now that were open in or around 1986? In other words, what's the longest open file your agency has? You know?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I can get you an exact number, but I am remembering a site off the top of my head that's 1992.
Okay.
So. And that was a big site access site, and that's the reason it's stuck in my head.
Do you know, and you may have said it and I've just missed it, but what's if there's an average time from the time, you know, a file is open to the time that there's closure or post-closure shutdown, is there any sort of industry or, when I say industry, agency average for those? How long does it take to clean up a site?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Generally, on average, I think there's a bunch of buckets depending on complexity. A good rule of thumb is if you just come up with, I have a typical gas station type site, 1 to 2 years is what we hope for. If everything goes according to plan, we do see that fairly regularly, but you can see where, you know, if you've drilled down and depending on where contamination may have gone in the aquifer, for example, imagine a site scored 7, so no one had touched it for decades, and then the owner wants to use the LSSI and is like, come on in, here's $35,000 for assessment, and it got down to the aquifer, and you're looking at air sparging and filtration, all kinds of stuff, that obviously complicates the issue. That's why we stress on getting assessments in and then hopefully getting dirt turned as soon after the assessment. We really don't want to see things get stale.
You're recognized.
How many counties of the 67 are directly involved in the petroleum cleanup program whereby they are actually the contractor for the engineers in that locality?
You're recognized. Thank you.
Roughly a third, sir. It doesn't vary too much anymore. We used to see less activity, but I think there's more interest now in counties. Again, it's a source of revenue. We have multiple programs that can go down to the counties where they can get some pass-through revenue. This is one of them. Inspections and enforcement of underground and above-ground storage tanks is another one, for example. And so we've seen counties start looking at that as not just an environmental protection from their perspective, but an actual source of revenue that can help take some of the burden off the locals. So we've seen an increase in interest in the last 5 or 6 years.
Last question, Madam Chair. Where do you see the inventory going in the next 5 years? You know, you've got 5 years on the job. So are we wrestling this bull by the horns? Are we getting some sort of closure so that we've got those down and minimizing any new files that are open because of best practices? Or what's your forecast?
You're recognized.
So we've done, obviously, we do back-of-the-napkin numbers all the time to look and try and do our best guesses. I think with the current scheme, to go to your second question first, with the current scheme of regulation, we do not see nearly the amount of issues, you know, obviously, that happened in the 80s and 90s and those types of things. So I think that is there's a very good handle around that. We've done internal back-of-the-napkin calculations, obviously, going, okay, given the number of sites that we have and scoring projections and what we know in the universe, if it was appropriated at $115 million a year, just carrying that forward as a hypothetical, close to 20 years to finish closing everything. If it was at $125 million a year, close to 12 to 14 years to finish everything. That is assuming, there's a caveat there that's important, because 60 million of that 125 million, we're just assuming going to the mega sites, right? So I'm just looking at a flat number each year and no projections on federal funding, like we had some ARPA funding and stuff.
Last one.
You're recognized.
And I think this is of interest not only to the members of the legislature, but members of the public as well. During these zombie properties, and they were not performing as far as paying their ad valorem taxes to the county and to the state, does the agency do any forecast as to those properties that have been placed back on the tax rolls and are now producing? How many millions of dollars in ad valorem taxes have that brought back to the local and the state local governments?
You're recognized.
We don't look at that level of detail, but I know on the advanced cleanup redevelopment specifically, we do an annual report every year, and then also there's voluntary tax credits that we wind up looking. So there is, on some of the redevelopment aspect, we do get a snapshot data source of, hey, this was the direct economic impact, but not to the level of individual county tax rolls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Representative Morales, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Going back to what my colleague just finished speaking, I'm interested in finding out of the 67 counties, you said 3% have participated in this type of program in the cleanup. Is there any way to get a copy of that to review it, like in my office? That's my question.
You're recognized.
Yes, I'm sorry if I misspoke. About a third of the counties act as local contractors was the point. And yes, I can certainly get a list and get it over to your office. Not a problem.
Okay, that was it. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue has been of interest to me for some of the same reasons that Chair Clemens commented on, the vacant properties. It's very visible and clear. I would be interested in getting an understanding of how Florida got the privilege of increased cost share on the project that you discussed earlier, and also just a kind of a sense of if you could provide it now, that I think what I'm hearing is that we aren't adding as much damage as we are mitigating in this project at this point. We are making progress over ground and in the improvements, but we have some big boulders still to move.
You're recognized.
To those two particular mega projects, so the Superfund one is, like I said, that's the one that's kind of the most unique, because usually when there is no available responsible party and it's considered to meet certain criteria threshold under Superfund, EPA takes it over. There was actually a lawsuit, like I said, and I think the date was 01, but I'll get that exactly, that someone was arguing no, based on the actual discharge, because it was all petroleum-based products, it occurred during the early detection incentive program, so therefore it should be eligible under that, regardless of the cost scale, because that wasn't a question when the EDI came out. So a judge ruled that it was. I know there's been some debates, you know, can we revisit it? The judge ruled that was 2 decades ago. It's final. We're on the hook for that one. Port Everglades, we didn't have a judge tell us, but it's a very similar, it's not a super fund, but it's a very similar set of facts. It was petroleum discharge. That occurred during the EDI program. Again, that wasn't capped in an amount. So the way that was set up, it's unfortunate, but logically that we're on the hook. And in terms of your other comment of, are we making a net gain? Yes, clearly, I think so. I know you wouldn't still see people beating down our door to get in the program as the score went down if they weren't trying to get this done. I mean, I can't envision that many people are going to go out and clean up a project and then just leave it. And then based on compliance issues that we see every year versus, you know, if you took even a 15-year-ago snapshot, we're definitely on the plus side of that ledger.
You have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Representative Roth, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. All these good questions by my colleagues have caused me to think about a question. It's a little bit uncomfortable to ask, but how long ago was this Port Everglades spill detected? I saw something online around 1999, and was this... is this area, was it part of a well monitoring program where they were already monitoring the area? How was it discovered, the degree of it? I'd just like a little more background on Port Everglades.
You're recognized.
I don't want to get any facts wrong, so I'm going to circle back with all the details. But initially, so it was discovered during a few different projects, so where you had sediment sampling and that type of thing, and I do believe it was the late 90s. That's why I want to make sure I get the exact right date. I'm getting old. Dates are getting mushy in my head now. So I want to get that date to you. But, yes, it had to do with a berth widening project. And then when they sampled the sediment, it wasn't an issue like we had back in the 40s, you know, where typically you would take the transformers and the dielectric fluid. It was just considered normal that you dumped into the water and then we're seeing that contamination now. It wasn't something like that. It was something that should not have happened. But the sedimentation sampling came up, and it was determined that at the time when they finished that project, if I remember correctly, the idea would be, let's not disturb anything else because we've got the port set how we're going to have the berth set. But now with the berth widening project, you're going to be needing to pull out bulkheads, and all that contaminated sediment that was there is going to get stirred up. So to ensure that you don't have that flowing elsewhere and those turbidity problems, it was determined that now would be the time to tackle it, again, based on an expansion.
Follow up.
Port Everglades is a major site for importing fuel into the state of Florida, and that's what I was kind of curious. So you're basically saying that this is legacy contamination that may have been years and years ago, and as you're expanding a berth or whatever, that's where the contamination was. It's not related to current fuel storage depot industry concerns.
You're recognized.
Yes, that's correct. It isn't a, this is a bad practice and we just deal with the contamination that comes from it. It was a historical, and I don't know if particularly it was a spill or two or something like that, but I'll get that information to your office. But like I said, it does not have to do with current practice and oversight that we have at these types of facilities in the state of Florida.
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Deputy Secretary Truitt, for our conversation last week. I fear if you and I were left alone to talk about this stuff, we might go on for days. When I'm looking, and I don't know if we have the ability to roll this thing back, but when I look at that'll work. The negative 600 sites, we understand that. We're bringing 800 sites into play. Can you walk me through what the costs associated with updating ground soil and groundwater conditions with kind of reloading those sites, or maybe even on the site scored 11, that have previously been assessed? How do you think about what that cost per site is just to get back to level ground, for lack of a better term?
You're recognized.
So I won't speculate on an individual number, but I understand the point you're getting at. So hopefully this answer is more helpful than an actual number. So we have, for example, in one of our rules, it's 270 days from the last sampling event. But again, that was important that I said that because it's in one of our rules, which gives us the ability to waive and some flexibility to deal with that. So I know I've had some entities already reach out to me generally saying, hey, I have a suite of projects. I've had individual entities reaching out going, I have this project. And what I've instructed my restoration folks is, let's not make everyone double pay. If there is not a very valid geologic or engineering reason, and I've got some good folks, in my side of the house, I've got Florida Geological Survey on my side of the house as well. If there's not a good reason by those licensed experts to say, go do this, don't check a box just because it says check a box. So we do want to minimize that impact is our intent.
You're recognized.
Yeah, that's excellent, because historically we've kind of yo-yoed, right, on restarts. Okay, so when we're looking at this for $125 million, but we have two mega projects. We kind of discussed this a little bit, but for the benefit of the committee, it's about $60+ million for those two mega projects, obviously not normal over the course of the history of the program. So really we have effectively $60 or so million to handle all of these other sites this year. Am I understanding that right?
You're recognized.
The $60 million should be, in theory, split over two fiscal years. So it would be...
Okay, so 90. And,
right.
Okay. Would it make sense?
You're good.
Would it make sense to take a look at trying to backfill that this year, that $25, $30, $40 million, whatever it is, to make sure that we're not kind of taking a step back? And then what would that mean, should we do it, for those projections that you kind of rolled out, the 10 to 12 years versus the longer play?
You're recognized.
I'll tackle the projection first. So if you're assuming that might take off roughly half a year, like when you're looking at the overall numbers out to 12 to 14 years, making sure there was an extra $60 million, for example, for the megasites might trim off a half to a year total. I'd have to go back and pull up the Excel and have people smarter than me work on that. In terms of the backfilling, so I know this was part of our discussion as well last week. When you look at the mega projects, even though the dollar amount is huge, it's not a large additional workload increase from a department perspective, right? The projects are very, very expensive because the scope is huge. But from my folks that have to review this, it's not like, oh, that project is going to take 40 extra people versus another project. So I say all that to say that backfilling would not pull extra people off the other projects, right? The other PRP program should continue to work. It's literally an economic question in terms of affecting other projects, not a staffing question. So, I mean, it's certainly, that's one option to keep the, to get to the idea of have the program continue rolling as it's rolling. That would be an item that would be required if you wanted to hold the others harmless, so to speak.
Sure. Thank you for that. So when we think about it in terms of that 10 or 12 years, if we were to fund it at, if we were not to sweep, right, like we have historically, have you modeled what that would mean? Do we go from 10 to 12 to, say, 6 or 5 years?
You're recognized. Okay.
And if not, what's that balance?
Right. Again, this was part of our discussion as well. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the program, we have a lot of private contractors that do a lot of the oversight and work, Teams 5 and Team 6, that are, we oversee their activity, but they're outside our house. So the first question we have to ask them is, if more funding were to be available, can you ramp up to handle that extra workload? So this is the caveat I gave you. They have all told us they can. So I will presume they are correct, because I don't get in their business for that perspective. From our staffing perspective, it would be very small. I think if, you know, we've looked at, if you went to 150 or 160, you might get down to 8 or 9 years, would be the hope. The issue is we haven't looked much past 150 to 160, because I'm a little uncomfortable with speculating that the private teams could infinitely ramp up forever. That's the only caveat I have. But again, that's the, based on what they say, that's what we've looked at.
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's extremely helpful. Is one last question, Secretary, and I know a little bit of this is redundant for us, but is there anything we can do in this body to really make it clear? I mean, I think over the history of this program, the starting and stopping, right, has been what has extended this thing out 3 decades. It was essentially, or it was supposed to be a 15 to 20 year program when it started. We're over 30 years and we're looking at another 10 to 12. And that's if nothing goes wrong and something's going to go wrong. So is there anything in your mind that we can be doing, perhaps not in the Appropriations Committee, but more on a policy side to avoid the joysticking of this, the starting and the stopping?
You're recognized.
I'm not too sure about a simple answer to it, because again, using by statute, we have to look at the EDR projections and base the health of the trust fund. And we look out multiple years. You know, we don't look at a snapshot of what's the health of the trust fund for fiscal year 20 to 21 and then put a blinder on and start fresh. We have to project out multiple years. So we're a little beholden to those projections. In terms of stop and starting, let's take the hypothetical, for example, if you had serious revenue impacts, that then the trust fund would, you know, look like, oh, no, we have to stop and we have to move the scores back up. I mean, there's always an option of trying to, you know, go through some kind of a budget amendment process or something like that to backfill. But based on, like I said, the EDR projections really drive it. You know, the super simple answer, which I don't think would work, would be in statute, say, once you've lowered the score to X, you cannot raise it again. Well, at some point, if you did that and there was an actual revenue shortfall, you're just going to run out of revenue in month 9 of a given year. And yeah, we didn't change the score, but nobody's having any work done. So I apologize for not having a better answer. But obviously, when that happened during the start of our pause, we were beating our heads against the wall, quite honestly, to try and figure out a way to avoid it and mitigate it. And we couldn't come up with anything better.
Okay. Thank you.
Members, any further questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for being with us today. To both of our presenters, we really appreciate your time. This concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Rep. Chambliss moves we rise, and without objection, the meeting is adjourned.